Welcome back to the Real Talk with Dana podcast, where we talk all things nutrition, health, fitness, and mindset with a healthy side of sarcasm. I'm your host, Dana Montes of Real Food with Dana. I'm a nutritionist and body image coach, teaching women how to heal their relationship with food and their bodies, ditch the diet cycle for good, and truly thrive with real food, one delicious meal at a time.
You know what it's time for right now? It's time for you to have a great time and do whatever it is you do while listening to this podcast. So welcome back to Real Talk with Dana, episode 89. First things first, big shout out to today's show sponsor, Just Thrive, and a reminder that you can get 10% off your order of prebiotic, probiotic, and vitamin K2 supplements at www.justthrivehealth.com. So this week's guest, in continuing with the theme of gut health this month, is Kelsey Kinney, who is a registered dietitian who you may know from the days of the Ancestral RDs podcast. Her maiden name is also Kelsey Marksteiner, if that rings a bell for you like it did for me. And we're talking all about probiotics, antibiotics, and a non-diet first approach to gut health. Cool. Well, welcome to the podcast, Kelsey. Thanks so much for coming on.
Thank you. I'm excited to be here.
So why don't we get started and just, you know, introduce yourself a little bit for the listeners if they haven't heard of you before or if they haven't heard of you with this name. Tell me a little bit more about your background and why you wanted to become a dietitian in the first place, and then what led you to specialize in gut health in particular.
Sure. So I have always kind of been interested in nutrition. I was just kind of fascinated by the idea that what we put in our body could really affect how our body performs and how it acts and our risk for, you know, future disease. So I've always kind of had that inherent interest, I think, in nutrition and just sort of like the medical background. That was certainly something that I grew up just having an innate passion for. And I, of course, decided that I wanted to do something totally different with my life. I was going to become an actress and sing and do musicals.
Awesome.
And so I actually went to college my first year to do that in New York City. And it was funny, my mom was kind of like, you know, don't you think you should go somewhere that also has a nutrition program? Like, just in case, you know, trying not to force me to do anything and let me make my own mistakes. And of course, I'm like, no, it's fine, mom, I don't care. So I go to New York, go to a school, of course, that does not have nutrition in the program, you know, anywhere in their school. And after the first year, I'm like, you know what? I think I got to switch to nutrition. So I transferred schools and, you know, sort of realized at that point that, okay, this is something I really enjoy and I really like. So from there on out, you know, I was very, very into it. And I think around that time is when the interest in gut health was becoming a little bit more popular. I mean, certainly not to the point that it is today. But there, you know, I was hearing about gut health a little bit within my nutrition program. And one of my professors actually was doing some more kind of intense research on intestinal permeability in patients in like the ICU, you know, so like trauma induced leaky gut essentially is what was happening. And so she was doing a lot of research on that and the effect of glutamine on those patients. So that kind of sparked an even deeper interest in gut health in particular, because I just thought that was really, really interesting and fascinating. And really, honestly, the rest is history for me. Once I sort of started to get into it, I was like diving into Google Scholar and PubMed like it was my job and just sort of getting really, really into that and started just kind of gathering my own thoughts on that based on the research. And then eventually I started my blog and started writing about it. So that's kind of my history in a nutshell, I would say, and how I got into this.
I love that. Thanks so much for sharing. So it's been a while since I talked specifically about leaky gut and intestinal permeability. So for the listeners who might need a refresher, could you give like a brief overview of what those are?
Yeah, absolutely. So leaky gut, if you've heard of that before, is just kind of the colloquial term for intestinal permeability. That's the more scientific term, what you might see in research. And what that means is essentially that your gut lining, which is really just one cell layer, starts to basically kind of spread apart. And so you end up with these little leaks or holes in the lining. And that, when that happens, it allows bigger particles, bacteria, kind of inflammatory things to flow through from the gut into the bloodstream. So you can imagine when that happens, you know, your immune system is not very happy about it and starts to sort of react to a lot of the things that are now flowing through your bloodstream. And research has shown that this intestinal permeability or leaky gut kind of leads to essentially a low-grade systemic inflammatory state because of some of the things that are flowing into the bloodstream. And that systemic inflammation has been associated with lots of different health conditions, you know, anything from diabetes or obesity to skin conditions like eczema. That really, it kind of runs the gamut in terms of what that inflammation can affect. And we're just at the tip of the iceberg with that research too.
Yeah, and then what about dysbiosis and how that happens?
Yeah, so dysbiosis is basically just a term that means imbalanced gut bacteria. So normally, you've got your large intestine. That's where most of the bacteria in your gut is housed. And there should be kind of a lot of good bacteria and a little bit of bad bacteria, or kind of even bad bacteria isn't necessarily the best word for it, but like commensal bacteria. So bacteria that doesn't really cause a lot of problems for you. They just sort of hang out there and don't do anything good or bad, but they benefit from being there, obviously, since they've got a house. And then, you know, sometimes we'll get bad bacteria like a parasite or something like that. But occasionally some of those commensal bacteria can start to overgrow. They kind of have an opportunity to do that sometimes when we're not fueling our good bacteria enough. So maybe we're not providing enough fiber, for example. And so our good bacteria counts start to go down. And you can think of the microbiome sort of as a parking lot. So there's only like so many spaces available for different kinds of bacteria. And so normally a lot of those spaces are taken up by the good bacteria, a little bit from those commensal or, you know, somewhat bad bacteria. And so if we're not feeding that good bacteria and they start to decrease and they don't take up as many of those parking spaces, then there's more open parking spaces. And then those commensal or bad guys, they start to get, you know, kind of excited about that. And they'll start to take over more of those empty spaces. And eventually you get this imbalance between the good and the bad, where the bad is kind of overgrowing or overpopulating the good. And that is what we call dysbiosis, that imbalance of good and bad bacteria. Does that make sense?
Yes. Yes. Thank you. And then one of the ways that this dysbiosis or imbalance of good versus bad or good versus commensal or opportunistic bacteria can happen is with antibiotic use. And I wanted to talk about this because I talked about this a couple weeks ago. I did a podcast on probiotics and antibiotics and prebiotics, but I wanted to dig into it a little bit more because we've always assumed, well, at least always, right? In like, as you said, like the right. Iceberg of the knowledge that we have on gut health for the past, 10, 20 years. But we've been using in clinical practice, based on the research, the fact that we maybe would do well to take probiotics with rounds of antibiotics and then following antibiotics to help with recovery of the gut microbiome and to prevent any antibiotic-associated digestive issues. But there has been some recent research over the past year or two that makes this assumption a little bit murky. So could you talk about the research and what it might suggest?
Sure. So I think one of the main studies that you're referring to, I think it may have been within the last year even. It was pretty recent, where they basically gave probiotics to people that were on antibiotics and saw that taking antibiotics actually kind of delayed the amount of time that it took for that person's microbiome to go back to what it was before taking antibiotics. Is that the one? One of the ones you're talking about? Probiotics, sorry. Yes.
Yes. Yeah, that's what I'm talking about.
Yeah. So, like we've been saying, you know, we're sort of right at the tip of the iceberg of everything that there probably is to know about the microbiome. So, personally, I take this study with a little bit of a grain of salt. Just because it's one study, we don't totally know what it means yet. But it does indicate that we should be maybe a little bit hesitant to take antibiotics, at least after being on antibiotics. I do still think that there's some benefit to taking antibiotics or probiotics with antibiotics, because we do have a lot of research that supports the idea that taking probiotics with antibiotics can help prevent things like antibiotic-associated diarrhea. So if you've ever taken antibiotics, you probably know that one of the most annoying side effects of taking them is that gastrointestinal upset. A lot of us will get diarrhea when we take antibiotics. And so taking probiotics can help prevent that. And so that can be very, very useful, not only from a compliance standpoint, you know, someone's much more likely to finish their round of antibiotics if they're not dealing with all these terrible side effects.
Right.
But also, you know, I think it just helps from a mental standpoint too. Like it's so much more pleasant to be able to go through your antibiotic course if you're not suffering the whole time. So personally, I think that there is some benefit to doing that when you're actually on antibiotics. And maybe some research will come out soon that totally doesn't support that. You know, things are changing within the microbiome world. So anything I say today could change tomorrow. And that's just sort of where we're at with all of this, which is a little bit unfortunate, of course, right? Because it makes life a little bit hard. But we just got to do the best that we can with the information that we have.
Yes.
But what this study for me kind of put a little bit of a hesitation with is this idea that you should be taking probiotics after antibiotics and kind of like using that as a way to repopulate your microbiome. Because what they essentially found, and I think I haven't looked at the study in a while, but I think that they basically found that, you know, anytime they continued with the probiotics after antibiotics, it just kept on delaying the return to their quote unquote normal bacteria. So basically what it looked like before they were on the antibiotics. So I would love to see more research in this area because it's fascinating, obviously, and it has a lot of implications for how we might change, you know, how we use probiotics in combination with antibiotics or after antibiotics. But right now, I haven't made too many changes in what I personally do or what I recommend to my clients because I do a lot based on symptoms, so how someone's feeling on something. So of course, if they're feeling better with a probiotic when they're taking antibiotics, that to me is better than suffering through antibiotics alone and not having a good time with that. And then afterwards, you know, I kind of play it by ear a little bit. I will usually try to take someone off of probiotics and just see how they feel to sort of give that, give the microbiome a chance to maybe get back to normal a little bit more easily. But if they feel way better on probiotics, at the end of the day, I'm probably going to keep them on probiotics because, again, this is one study. We don't know everything there is to know about it. So I think that for me, I'm kind of waiting for more. I don't feel comfortable yet totally changing how I'm dealing with this in practice. And I don't feel comfortable yet really using one study to make recommendations based on one study. You know, like I want a body of evidence to support a change if I'm going to do that. So this is the first step in that. And like I said before, maybe we'll have lots of other studies that are going to come out soon about this topic. And I hope we do, because I would like a little bit more clarity, and probably you would too.
Yeah, exactly. And that's kind of the reason why I wanted to bring this up, is to like offer it to people as a disclaimer of like, this is only one study. And it's also important to like note that it is only one study. It hasn't been replicated. There are a bunch of like very specific conditions that they used in the study that we would like to see replicated or with different conditions, right? Like this was one set of or two sets of antibiotics and one set of probiotics on like a very specific population of people. Right. But what about other types of antibiotics or other types of probiotics and stuff like that? But I just wanted to talk about this for people because just in case the media, you know, like gets a handle of this one mm-hmm. study that hasn't been replicated and they're like, actually, probiotics don't work at all. Like now you know this is the study that they've been referencing. But like Kelsey and I have been saying, it's only one study. But this is what the media does, right? They want very clickbaity headlines yes. and like, oh my gosh, like we're going to get so much traffic to our site and then they're going to freak everyone out and we're going to go from everyone believes, oh, everyone should be taking probiotics to, oh my God, probiotics are the worst thing in the world and you should never take them. And it's just like, all right, everyone chill out. It's yeah. only one study. Sometimes you do need to read the research and actually understand what it says before you can come to your own conclusions.
Exactly. And I think one of the things to keep in mind, too, just on that topic, is that probiotics in particular are so, so strain specific. So something that a probiotic does is completely specific to the one strain that it is. You cannot compare. It's like comparing apples to oranges between different strains, because one probiotic strain could be super helpful, for example, when you're taking antibiotics, whereas another one would be, you know, could potentially be really detrimental or could delay, like we've been talking about, delay the return back to a normal microbiome. So again, that just even further confirms that we really need more research, specifically with this when we're talking about probiotics.
Exactly. Yeah. So I want to go into that for a little bit because we were kind of talking before we got on the podcast and we want to do a little bit of debunking here because there are a lot of voices out there that are saying, specifically on social media and in the general media, right, that everyone should be taking probiotics or like higher potency must be better or anyone who has any kind of digestive issues should take all of like this product, like the same multi-strand high mm-hmm. potency probiotic. So what are your thoughts on that kind of stuff?
Yeah, I mean, I think with, of course, it sort of comes with gut health becoming more popular, I think. The more that we talk about gut health, the more we kind of run into some more misinformation because it's just more people talking about it, right? But one of the things, just going back to what I was saying before, to really keep in mind about probiotics is that their effects are strain specific. So again, you know, not everybody should be taking the same probiotic because one probiotic is going to do something completely different from another. And there is a lot of overlap between different strains. Like we definitely see that in the research. So for example, you know, two of my favorites are Culturelle and Florastore. They kind of have some overlap. They're both really great for antibiotic-associated diarrhea, for example. But they also have differences. You know, they have different things that they do. And then there's other strains that, like, for example, would be really great for vaginal health. Whereas if you're trying to take a probiotic for digestive health, maybe they're really not going to do all that much for you. So when we're talking about taking probiotics, you have to be really specific in what you want out of taking one. And that's going to dictate, of course, which actual probiotic strain you end up taking. And that also means that more is not necessarily better. You know, the different dosages of different probiotic strains could have totally different effects as well. So for one strain, you might only need 5 billion for it to be effective for a certain health condition. Whereas for another strain, you know, maybe you need 20 billion for it to be effective for whatever you're trying to deal with. So it's totally dependent on the strain and what we see in the research as to when, you know, at what level, at what dosage that becomes effective for certain things. So just to kind of quick myth bust there, we've basically said that, you know, more is not necessarily better and not all probiotics strains are created equally. They all have kind of different jobs and things that they're able to do. So hopefully that kind of breaks it down at least a little bit to start to understand why, even though you hear all these great things about probiotics, and believe me, they are great. I love them. I use them all the time in my practice. You have to be kind of careful with them. And you have to really be purposeful about using them.
Yeah, definitely. And it's funny because if we look at like the learning curve of when you first start learning about gut health and then you become a practitioner and you start right. practicing it and stuff, it's like you at first you're like, oh my God, like I know a lot of stuff about gut health. Like probiotics can be used for this and this. And then like the more you practice and the more you learn about them, it's like, oh my God, the more I realize I don't know about probiotics and antibiotics. So if this is freaking anyone out, it's okay. Like there's so much more research to be done. And like we've been saying the whole time, this is only the tip of the iceberg. So you kind of got to eat a dose of humble pie in that what we think we know today in 10 days or, you know, 5 years or whatever it is from now might be completely backwards given any new research. But we're just trying to do the best we can with the clinical experience that we have, with the evidence that we have in the research and all that kind of stuff.
Yeah, and this is not to overwhelm anyone, of course. And and trust me, even the researchers didn't totally understand this until pretty recently. Like if you look at research from 5 years ago, a lot of the time they're not even telling you what strain they used in a particular study because they didn't realize at that point that it was important. Mm-hmm. So they're just, you know, now starting to realize, oh, wow, the strain, not the species, is actually the most important thing. And just to break that down, so for example, a probiotic name, Lactobacillus rhamnosus GG. So Lactobacillus is the genus name, rhamnosus is the species, and GG is the strain. So you're kind of always going to be looking for that third combination of letters or numbers. That's the strain. So if you see a probiotic supplement that you're considering buying that does not tell you the strain, don't buy it. Because like we've been talking about, that strain is so important. It tells you the kind of properties of that particular probiotic. So if you just know up to the species level, that does not give you enough information and you have no idea what that probiotic strain is actually capable of.
Right. Exactly.
All right. Time for a little bit of a break to talk about a word from our sponsor. So let's say, hypothetically, for the past few weeks, you've been learning a lot about gut health, about probiotics, prebiotics, and what they do for the body. And while you now completely understand that no one supplement is going to fix everyone, you have been having some gut issues and you would like to try out a high quality probiotic that has been proven to arrive 100% alive to your intestines so those little good gut bugs can do their job. What you can do is get some goodies from Just Thrive. So Just Thrive is replacing the old outdated approach of reseeding an imbalanced or devoid gut microbiome, which we've been talking about in this episode, which basically with this approach, the assumption was you would be like throwing some new seeds into a totally dead garden and then expecting them to blossom into beautiful flourishing plants, which we now know is not the theory that works. And instead, we're focusing on a kind of reconditioning approach to gut health, where the Just Thrive probiotics and prebiotics are essentially crowding out the pathogens and the bad bacteria, allowing the good bacteria to grow and thrive in ratios that are optimal for your gut health, which then also improves your overall health, like digestion, your immune system, your mental health, and all of the good gut things. From not only delivering necessary probiotics and good bacteria to your gut, but also by delivering antioxidants to the GI tract that can help with inflammation. So I was thinking of coming up with like a fun new rhymey type phrase, like people use happy wife, happy life for gut health, which I guess could have been like happy gut, happy butt, and happy the rest of you because of that. But then aside from making me laugh a lot at my own joke, like that didn't really work, but you get the point. If your gut is happy, the rest of you is happy and much healthier for it. So anyways, bad jokes aside, if you're interested in trying out the completely allergen-free, spore-braced, high-quality probiotics from Just Thrive, you can get yourself some free money by using the code DANA10 for a 10% discount code off your order at www.justthrivehealth.com. Because now from this episode, while you understand that no one probiotic or supplement or diet can fix everyone, sometimes you just need a little bit of help. And trying out a probiotic or a prebiotic from Just Thrive is a really good way to see if it can help you. And now, back to the episode with Kelsey.
So I want to go back a little bit to talking about food, prebiotic and probiotic foods, and what we were talking about with antibiotics. So where do probiotic and prebiotic foods then play into antibiotic recovery if we're going to be a little bit more careful about recommending high doses of probiotics after antibiotics?
So, I mean, I'm a big fan of prebiotic and probiotic foods in general, and I think they should kind of always be part of the diet as much as you can. You know, obviously that one study does bring a little bit of a question to whether you should be really focusing on probiotic foods right after you're done with antibiotics. I don't really know the answer to that, and I don't think anybody knows the answer to that, whether we should really be doing it. So I would kind of just recommend going back to your typical habits. So if you're someone who normally, you know, is eating sauerkraut or yogurt or whatever kind of fermented food every day, just go back to that. But if you weren't doing that before, I don't think there's any reason that you should feel like right after antibiotics you should, you know, be including all the fermented foods all the time kind of thing. But prebiotics, I think, is a little bit of a different story. I do think that could be really, really helpful after antibiotics, because what a prebiotic does is it essentially fuels the good bacteria in your gut. So when you take an antibiotic, you're kind of killing off a lot of good and bad bacteria. And so you sort of just end up with a low level of everything in the gut after antibiotics. So if you start to provide fuel only to good bacteria, and that is the technical definition of a prebiotic. It cannot fuel or feed bad bacteria. It's only going to feed those good guys. So if you're providing lots of prebiotic material to those good colonies of bacteria, you're helping them to kind of regrow and get back to their normal state quicker. So I do definitely recommend prebiotic both foods and supplements after antibiotics. And again, you know, who knows? Research might show that that's not a good idea at some point in our life. But right now, to me, it makes sense. It works really well. I've seen it work in practice. So that's typically what I recommend. But for probiotics, I'd say kind of just go back to your, or probiotic foods, I'd say just go back to your typical routine after antibiotics.
Awesome. Thanks for that. And then throwing a little bit of a wrench into the equation of one of the instances where these recommendations might be a little bit different. What about with SIBO specifically?
Sure. Good question. So SIBO is kind of can be a little bit complicated, and we don't exactly know the best way to deal with SIBO in the first place. And it kind of tends to differ from person to person. But for those who don't know what SIBO is, it's basically an overgrowth of bacteria in the small intestine, which is normally at least somewhat sterile. There's not a whole lot of bacteria growth happening in the small intestine compared to the large intestine, where, you know, we have tons of our bacteria. That's where our whole microbiome is. So when you've got that overgrowth of bacteria in the small intestine, that can be both good and bad bacteria that's overgrowing there. Because remember, we're really not supposed to have much of anything there. So if something starts to grow like crazy, regardless of whether the strain is considered good or bad in the large intestine, and we kind of consider it bad in the small intestine because it's not supposed to be there. So prebiotics, I think there's a lot of debate over both prebiotics and probiotics in SIBO. Personally, in my own practice, I tend to use both unless someone has a negative response to it. And that happens. You know, again, I find SIBO, dealing with SIBO to be very personal, and it differs from person to person. So some people really don't tolerate the probiotics or really don't tolerate the prebiotics. But also, we have to remember that probiotic strains all act differently. And same with prebiotics. They all have kind of different ways that they affect people. So just because, you know, maybe you try one prebiotic and one probiotic when you have SIBO and they don't work, doesn't mean that all of them aren't going to work. So typically if that happens, you know, I'll discontinue whatever we started on, but I might try something different. I might try them on a different probiotic strain, or I might try them on a different prebiotic. So I don't think that they're necessarily bad. And there is some evidence to actually suggest that they can be useful in SIBO, despite what that sounds like. Because, right, we just talked about a prebiotic feeding bacteria, which seems like we don't necessarily want to do that. But especially if you're taking antibiotics or antimicrobials for SIBO to help get those bacteria levels down, research shows that some prebiotics can actually be really helpful in that, and they help to lower those counts even more than if someone was taking antibiotics without prebiotics. So I think it's really personal, and I think we're going to learn more about it as more research comes out. But right now in practice, I do tend to use both prebiotics and probiotics when dealing with SIBO.
Awesome. Thanks for that. Okay. Now definitely want to switch gears a little bit. I just hit my microphone a little bit. That's fine.
So happens to the best of us.
Exactly. So I want to talk about an article that you wrote pretty recently about why you don't use a diet-first approach to gut health. Because there are so many people out there who believe that and put out that you can fix everything with food, or maybe they believe that you should just always start with food first, no matter what the condition is. So what do you mean when you say you don't use a diet-first approach to gut health and healing?
Yeah, so I should start by saying that when I really don't take the diet-first approach is when we're talking about digestive health conditions. So something like IBS, for example, where we're really like we know there's probably dysbiosis or SIBO present usually with a condition like that. The reason I won't do diet first or kind of come at it from a diet first approach, meaning that I'm really focusing the approach with diet only and kind of forgetting about a lot of other things, is because at the end of the day, a lot of those digestive kind of conditions are related to dysbiosis, imbalanced gut bacteria, SIBO. So when you use food to deal with that, it doesn't really work. You can't starve out an infection unless you were, you know, doing this some kind of crazy, crazy strict diet for years, probably. You would not be able to get rid of an infection like SIBO, for example, or you would not be able to starve a parasite or something. So it becomes more important at that point to focus on things like antimicrobials. Or, you know, in the case of SIBO, sometimes antibiotics can be a good option. So we kind of need to come at it from a bacteria first approach, because that typically is at the root of what is causing these problems for someone. So, you know, yes, diet can play a little bit of a role in symptom management for somebody, but at the end of the day, it's not going to cure their condition. It's not going to rebalance their gut bacteria, because their gut bacteria typically is so kind of imbalanced already that any changes in diet are not going to be enough. And that differs. You know, for example, like if someone, let's say, you know, has metabolic syndrome and they, you know, maybe they don't have like, they don't have SIBO, they maybe just have a little bit of imbalanced gut bacteria. There's nothing super wrong maybe in the gut, but it is imbalanced to some degree. And there's definitely research to show that that can play a role in something like metabolic syndrome. Then maybe coming at it from a diet first approach and increasing fiber, increasing polyphenol intake, things like that, could be really helpful to that person. And we may not need to go to the antimicrobials and focus so heavily on killing off bacteria and doing things like that. But for a lot of people with digestive conditions, you know, we're coming in with such an imbalance typically with the gut bacteria that it just doesn't make sense to start with food or focus our approach around food.
Right. And I really like that you said you can't starve the bacteria while you're eating real food or whatever the restrictive approach is, unless it's extremely restrictive over years, because that's something that you hear so often is like, oh, you know, we're just going to do super low carb, or we're going to do low FODMAP, or we're going to do whatever it is, and then you're going to starve off the bacteria. But then what actually happens is you might make those bacteria or whatever it is go dormant and the symptoms are going to go down, but that doesn't mean they're actually going away or being killed off by just diet changes alone.
Right, exactly. So basically, as soon as you start to eat those foods again, which for many people with digestive conditions, you know, that's their end goal, is to be able to get to a place where they can have a well-rounded diet and not feel like they need to be so restrictive about their diet to keep their symptoms under control. But when they start to eat those foods that they've then restricted, you know, bring them back again, those symptoms usually all come raging back. So it's just really, it's counterproductive. It's not helpful in the long run. And of course, it's just a pain in the butt to do. You know, nobody wants to be on a super restrictive diet for a really long time.
Right. And then speaking of that, how can trying to improve your gut health through these restrictive diets impact your relationship with food?
I mean, I have seen it. I'm sure you've seen it. But a lot of clients that come to me that they've tried to like do this on their own from a diet first approach. And they've just kept restricting, you know, taking things out thing after thing. Cause they take one thing out, maybe it works for a little while, but then their symptoms get worse again. So they're like, oh, I should take out another thing. And so on it goes. And eventually they get down to, you know, 5 or 10 foods, let's say, that they're eating. And that really messes with you from a mental standpoint. To be so restricted, first of all, it's really hard to socialize, you know, when you're that restricted with your diet. It just messes with your ability to gain pleasure from your food. And that's a big piece of what food is all about, you know, that we enjoy it, that we eat it with other people. And so to have that really mess with your relationship with food over time, I think can be way more detrimental than we think it is. And so that's, again, why I really try not to go down that road. And unfortunately, I tend to get a lot of clients who've already gone down that road by themselves. And eventually they, you know, realize that that's not a good idea and it's not helping them in the long run. But if I can catch somebody before they go down that road, it's great, because I prevent that relationship with their food from becoming, you know, dysfunctional, I guess I would say.
Yeah, definitely. And it's so challenging when we work with these kinds of clients, which like just so happens that like many people that have these gut issues have developed them as a side effect or as a cause of, or in some relation to some kind of restrictive type of eating or disordered eating or, you know, whatever it was. A lot of the time, gut issues will come with these fears of certain foods, because once you start having gut issues, mm-hmm. you start doing all your own research and you're like, oh, I shouldn't be eating beans and I shouldn't be eating grains and gluten must be bad and dairy must be bad because it's fermentable. And, you know, you have right. all these lists of foods in your head that you then, whether or not they're actually causing you symptoms, you start to actually become afraid of them because you associate them with physical pain via digestive system or digestive issues or brain fog or whatever it is. And so how can you start to help people getting out of those fears while improving their gut health at the same time?
Yeah. So, I mean, a lot of the times what I do with my clients is right away, you know, we do some testing typically to just kind of take a look at their gut, their bacterial balance in the gut. And more often than not, like I was saying before, you know, anybody with digestive issues is going to have some kind of dysbiosis. So more often than not, we're getting them on some kind of antimicrobial. So we're helping to sort of kill off that bacteria. And from there, I try to start reintroducing foods pretty much right away, because people are often shocked by the fact that they can tolerate so many things that they thought they couldn't. And I think that goes back to what you were saying just about that kind of scaring yourself into thinking that so many foods are causing you problems when maybe they're really not. So I think part of it is that, you know, of course we're starting to kill off some of the bacteria that are related to the issues that someone is having. So that over time definitely increases the tolerance that somebody might have for foods that actually caused them problems before. But then there's also the piece of it too, that we're reintroducing foods that maybe someone just thinks that they have a problem with, but they really don't. And so with some, you know, support from someone that they're working with like me, you know, to just give them that encouragement to actually try these things. And, you know, we say the worst that can happen is that, you know, it doesn't work and we can always come back to it later. But just give it a try. And people, I can't tell you how many people I get that are just so shocked that they can tolerate so many more foods than they thought they could. It's really amazing.
Exactly, which is so cool. And then I also want to talk about under eating with restrictive diets and healing, because when we know, or we know when you're trying to heal and nourish your body and recover from whatever digestive or health issues you've been having, if you're going on these restrictive diets, most people have a tendency to actually under eat, which can then impede their healing.
Absolutely. I mean, that is really, really common. Anytime you're on a diet that takes out, for example, a whole group of foods. So let's say you're on some candida kind of diet that really takes out like all sources of carbs and sugar and all that kind of stuff. It becomes actually quite difficult to get enough calories, especially if you're active in any way. It just gets really, really hard to do that. Or let's say FODMAPs is actually a really good example, because the way the low FODMAP diet is meant to be implemented is actually in a three-phase process where you restrict first for literally like 2 weeks, and then you start the reintroduction process, because you won't respond equally to all the different FODMAP categories. And then you end up in phase three with kind of your own personalized quote-unquote low FODMAP, which may not really even be super low FODMAP, diet that you personally tolerate. But what a lot of people do is they just go on that totally restrictive, super low FODMAP part and just stick with that for a really long time. And with all those restrictions, it becomes very difficult to get enough calories. And so when that happens, I mean, we can think of being on basically a low calorie diet compared to what our body is asking for as being another stressor. And so when your body is trying to heal, adding another stressor onto it, and in addition to that, potentially maybe not providing enough, micronutrients, so all the vitamins and minerals that would be helpful to the healing process, that just makes it so much harder for your body to get to where it needs to be. So that's one of the things that I really try to look out for with digestive health clients, because it's such an easy trap to fall into when you start to restrict your diet, you get on these low calorie diets by accident, basically, that then impede your healing.
Right, exactly. And it's so complicated too, because a lot of the time with digestive issues, if people are experiencing like extreme bloating or constipation or diarrhea, something that might involve some kind of like water or weight retention, if they're then under eating on these restrictive diets and then they start to lose weight, they're like, oh my gosh, I'm getting better because I'm losing the bloat, or I'm losing the, you know, right, whatever. But like, losing weight on these restrictive diets doesn't actually mean that you're fixing the problem or getting healthier.
Totally, totally. And yeah, it's really easy to think that that is happening. But yeah, it's unfortunately not with that kind of case.
So complicated. So
complicated. I know, right? Well, no wonder we're all confused.
Right, exactly. No wonder we're all confused. And no wonder, like, the more you learn as a practitioner, the more confused you become. And then you start doubting everything that you know. It's like, this is a normal totally. Thing that happens. It's fine.
Right.
Oh, man. Well, hopefully this was very debunking and illuminating about a lot of things for the listeners today. So thank you so much for coming on. Please tell people, well, actually, before I even go there and you can plug all your things, this is a fun, totally unrelated to gut health question. What is a book that you have been loving lately? And it can be a fun book or it can be a nutrition book, whatever you like.
Ooh, that is a good question. I am currently reading a book called The Whisper Man, which is a thriller. I think it's called The Whisper Man, or at least something like that. those are the only kind of fun books I read, are like mystery thriller books. So I've got my category and I just stick with it. And some of them are bad and some of them are great, but you know, that's me. That's my category. So this one so far is good, but I'm not done with it yet. So we'll see.
Cool. Well, that's awesome. I will link that in the show notes for anyone who is interested. And then tell people where they can find you. And if you want to plug anything, now is a great time to do that.
Cool. You can find me on Instagram at It's Kelsey Kinney. And you can find me on Facebook, same thing, Kelsey Kinney, just my name. And I also do make prebiotic probiotic drink mixes, which I just launched that fairly recently.
Oh, cool.
So our first one is a prebiotic probiotic matcha. It's really great. It's got no other ingredients in it. It's just a prebiotic powder, a probiotic powder, and matcha tea powder, organic matcha tea powder. So you can find that at gutpowerdrinks.com, and you can follow us on Instagram or Facebook at gutpowerdrinks too. And for your listeners, if you guys are interested in trying that, you can get 15% off by just using the code HELLO off your first order.
Oh, awesome. Well, I will for sure put that in the show notes. Well, Kelsey, thank you so much for coming on.
You are so welcome. This was really fun, Dana.
Thanks for listening to Real Talk with Dana. If you enjoyed the episode, please share it with your family and friends and share the love by throwing us a 5-star rating and review on iTunes, which will help spread the word and do a small part to correct all of the fitness and nutrition misinformation or bullshit that's out there, which is only causing people to become more unhealthy. Come find me anywhere at Real Food with Dana on Instagram and Facebook. Join the Real Talk with Dana Facebook group for more support and discussion on these episodes. And come hang out over on realfoodwithdana.com for the show notes and totally epic and delicious recipes. All right, guys. Well, I hope you enjoyed this episode. So don't forget, get your gut health in check and grab some probiotics and prebiotics. And be sure to use the code DANA10 at www.justthrivehealth.com to get some free money and save 10% off your order.